Ah, well, gee, I hardly know where to start. I've been working on some notes, and I just came back from a screening and all of that. Maybe, why don't we just ease into this a little bit? If you could settle back and tell me a little bit about some of your own interests in Mars, maybe how far back you go with this, some of the stuff you've read, and some bio information as we go. Why don't you just take off maybe some of your first impressions of the planet, and was it through reading or through just looking up into the sky, that sort of thing?
Well, it was in part of doing research for other science fiction stories, and I spent a lot of time in the wilderness as much as I can, and especially in the mountains and the desert. And so when I saw the first photographs of from the Viking mission to Mars in 77 and 78, at least that was when I became aware of it, it seemed to me immediately that it was an interesting place. In fact, a magnificent place, very wild. And so I began to read more about it then and got the idea that I would eventually do a long work about Mars and started reading about it, everything that I could find, both nonfiction and fiction.
Now, at this time, you were what, like in your late teens?
No.
Tried to get my decades.
I must have been about 25 or so.
Okay. And what was it you were doing for a living at that point?
I was a graduate student, and I taught freshman composition, and I was writing science fiction already at that point.
And you were living where?
That would be San Diego.
Uh-huh. Now, at this point, had you already been writing yourself, or were you pursuing another career altogether as an educator?
No, I had been writing and selling science fiction stories from about 1974.
Uh-huh.
So while I was doing my graduate student work in literature, I was also writing and selling science fiction short stories.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was writing another story that was set in the solar system when I started looking up Mars books just to research mm-hmm. that story.
And at this point, was there a mentor, a guide, somebody that you knew who was sympathetic to both the literary and the science fiction, not to divide them necessarily, but was sympathetic to both endeavors?
Well, I had a couple of people on both sides of that fence who were sympathetic. In the science fiction world, Damon Knight was the first editor who bought my stories, and so he was sort of like a patron in that he was buying stories from me when nobody else was, and it was a very good motivator for me to work really hard on the science fiction.
And which magazine was that?
That was his Orbit anthology.
Orbit, right.
Which came out like once a year back then.
Okay.
And so Damon Knight was, you know, my first editor for about 5 years. He was my main support in the science fiction world, and he taught me a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the university, I was lucky enough to have as an advisor Frederick Jameson, who has since gone on to become one of the most famous literary critics working today. And he was very interested in science fiction and was a big fan of Philip K. Dick and encouraged me to work on Philip K. Dick for my graduate studies.
That's where I've heard the name Jameson, with Philip K. Dick, I believe, right.
Also, he's a big theorist of postmodernism now, so that his book on postmodernism is probably the one that is most often cited when people try to understand that mm-hmm. term.
Now, before we get away from the more traditionally academic and literary matters,
mm-hmm.
what had you done a master's thesis or a dissertation, and was it totally away from the science fiction field?
Well, no, I got a typical literature bachelor's degree from UC San Diego and then a master's degree from Boston University.
Boston?
Yeah. And then I came back to UC San Diego when Jameson was there, and he got me started on a dissertation that was on the novels of Philip K. Dick. I think I was probably one of the first PhDs that was based on a Philip K. Dick's work. I'm almost positive.
Uh-huh.
And so this was something that he encouraged me to do. And I got a PhD in literature about 1982.
Was that one of the first, at least that you knew of, one of the first PhDs to center wholly upon an individual science fiction writer? I guess that sort of thing's been done, though, hasn't it?
I think maybe there were a few earlier ones because there was a series of dissertations that were science fictional in nature that was published by University UMI Research Press, which was a subsidiary of Xerox, and And my dissertation was published in this series, and I noticed there were several about Le Guin and Bradbury, and, you know, sort of the classics had some people had got their PhD working in this material before me.
Mm-hmm.
But I think mine was the first on Philip K. Dick.
Now, I'm going to read a quote to you. It's one of my favorite ones, and it's expressed by Sachs, of all people, in the book, about the beauty of Mars existing in the human mind. He says, "It's we who understand it and we who give it meaning. All our centuries of looking up at the night sky and watching it wander through the stars, all those nights of watching it through the telescopes, looking at a tiny disk, trying to see canals and the albedo changes, all those dumb sci-fi novels with their monsters and their maidens and dying civilizations, and all the scientists who studied the data or got us here, that's what makes Mars beautiful." That's really nice, because you really do seem to be paying tribute to both the more absurdly fantastic narratives as well as the more rigorously scientific views. Is that a fair interpretation of those words on my part?
Oh, yes. And you know, I think they feed into each other very much, because it really, the fantasies of people like Burroughs were based on the hardest data that they had at the time of Schiaparelli and Lowell. And it was really the best speculation of the time that there might be dying civilizations on Mars. And so, and then the further along, the fantasies of people like Burroughs and Wells and that generation were inspiration to some of the rocket scientists like von Braun, who was influenced by a German book called Two Planets by Kurt Loswitz. And the Russian rocket teams were very influenced by a early Bolshevik utopia called Red Star by a guy named Bogdanov. And so science fiction and and planetary science have been feeding off of each other in a kind of a back-and-forth way now for several generations.
Now, see, there it is, the name Bogdanov, another reference that had escaped me.
Yes, very much so.
Well, let's go back to Burroughs for a second. I remember even as a kid thinking, what a preposterous piece of whimsy, fun nonetheless, of an atmosphere-making plant. And yet, on Red Mars,
yeah,
that's what they're really trying to do, in a sense, isn't it?
That was an early stab at the Gaia hypothesis. Rather wonderful that he understood that.
Uh-huh. I suppose, too, I was going to talk about life on Mars. Let me defer that for just a moment. Had you read the Burroughs books as a child?
Not as a child. I didn't run into them until I discovered science fiction as a college undergraduate. So I came on all this kind of late. And they did not have the magical quality for me that they would have if I had discovered them when I was 12, because I was a voracious reader and throughout my life.
Uh-huh.
And it's too bad that I didn't run across them when I was younger, but I was a patron of one of those public libraries that was rather puritanical. I don't think Edgar Rice Burroughs was in that library, to tell you the truth.
Isn't that amazing?
Or else I would have found him, because I read almost everything else in there.
Well, let's leave Burroughs and Bradbury and Arthur C. Clarke aside for the moment. Who are some other writers, or even films, like Rocketship XM or something, that maybe did make an impact on you in those years?
Well, the only one really that in those years when I was young that I read that was recognizably science fiction was Jules Verne.
Mm.
But I didn't understand that there was a whole genre that continued to do what he had done. He was just slotted in with the rest of literature in my library, and so I thought of him as being one of a kind. And I read maybe 40 of... I read practically everything of Verne's that had been translated into English, including a lot of the really obscure works, and enjoyed it quite a bit, but I was basically a little bit science fiction deprived as a youngster.
Okay, so let's get to the time then when you first discovered something like Martian Chronicles.
Yeah, well, Martian Chronicles is peculiar. I only read that a year or so ago.
No kidding.
My understanding of all this stuff has been a little spotty, and when
wow.
I understood that I wanted to write about Mars, I collected every Martian novel that I could find, and I've got a whole shelf of them in my bookcase now. But some of them I've been a little bit reluctant to read just because I didn't want to be over-influenced in my own ideas. And Bradbury's book was so famous and so influential that I was a little bit scared of it. And so I didn't read it until I had Red Mars basically finished.
Uh-huh.
And then I read it, and I realized that it just it had very little relation to my own conception of Mars.
Although the idea about the people who arrive there will become Martians.
Yes, this is the main thing. In fact, somewhere I had read that last page from the story of Bradbury's called The Martians, which I think is the critical passage in all of his book.
Uh-huh.
And I had read that excerpted somewhere, and that indeed is a fundamental realization about what Mars is going to be for us.
Mm-hmm. You know, you mentioned that bookshelf of yours. Boy, would I love to get a look at that. Is it in front of you there?
I could switch phones to where it would be in front of me.
Well, why don't we do that for a second? I'll put this on pause.
Sure, because I've got it right there before the other phone. Just a second.
Okay.
Still there?
Yeah, I'm an inveterate snooper, I guess. I'd love to know what some of the titles are on that shelf. Now, these are specifically Martian epics, huh? All right, give me a few of those.
Well, my favorites are kind of shoved over to the left here, and they you'll recognize a lot of them. I mean, I've got the Martian Chronicles, and I've got Philip K. Dick's Martian Time Slip, and the Three Stigmata of Palmer Eldritch.
No, hold it right there. The Martian Time Slip, is that where you got that term?
Yes.
Another reference, okay.
Yes.
Now, what was the next one?
The Three Stigmata of Palmer Eldritch, which was the novel that Dick wrote right after Martian Time Slip, has a big section of it placed on Mars.
Now, that's Eldritch, I-D-G-E or E-D-G-E?
L-D-R-I-T-C-H.
Aha, uh-huh. Eldritch.
Three Stigmata.
Okay.
And then there's a novel called Farewell Earth Bliss by D.G. Compton.
Good grief.
Which is about Mars as a penal colony and as sort of an Australia to England analog that is really a good novel.
What are the years now of the Dick and the Compton thing?
Both of those are like 1965.
I'll be darned. Okay.
And then...
Any more?
I like Fred Pohl's Man Plus.
Hmm.
Which is from, like, 1976. And there is a novel by Frederick Turner, who is a professor down at University of Texas, Dallas, called A Double Shadow,
mm-hmm.
which was published in 78. And then just a couple years ago, he published an epic poem, which is about the terraforming of Mars.
Okay, now, is the word terraforming something that is current, or is that something that was coined by somebody?
That was coined by the science fiction writer Jack Williamson.
No kidding.
Yep. And he coined it back in the late 20s or early 30s in one of those Astounding magazine stories.
You don't remember which one?
No.
Well, I'll bet my dad would know that. I'll be darned.
Yeah, because that's one of the more famous word coinings that has mm-hmm. stuck and is now in general use.
I see. Now, what I'm getting at with all of these is that it strikes me that writing books about Mars is a specific subgenre of science fiction, is it not? I mean,
oh, it's huge. In fact, I'm looking at I literally am looking at a shelf that is.
Hello?
Yeah, I'm looking at a shelf that is like 35 books, 35 Mars novels, and that only includes two of the John Carter books.
Yeah. Now, is this, for a writer then, does this constitute something like tackling Mount Everest or, is it one of those hurdles that all writers eventually must somehow confront?
Well, I don't think, I'm not so sure about that. I think that there's a special class of science fiction writer, which are just the ones that have gotten interested in Mars and have realized that it has a literature of its own.
Yeah.
And so it isn't as if it's sort of a subcategory of the other planet novel. And I do think that all science fiction writers eventually try to take on the other planet novel. And as a subset of that, a major mm-hmm. subset would be the Mars novel.
Now, not knowing many of the books that you just cited,
mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if it was, did it take some courage on your part to not yield to the temptation to find life on the planet, or at least in the first novel, you haven't. And
it seemed to me that was the obvious course to take because the scientific evidence right now is against it, and I wanted to play it very, very much according to what we understand Mars is like.
Mm-hmm. And the way you put it is interesting. Who is it? is it Maya that says, let's see, there was never any spontaneous generation out of the clays or the sulfuric hot springs. No spores falling out of space. And here's the killer, no touch of a god. What an interesting way of putting it.
Mm-hmm.
Those are your words, or hers, I forget right. whose. No touch of a god.
Well.
I mean, that's one of the more intriguing phrases in the book. I'm not sure quite what I'm looking for when I cite it to you, but.
I just wanted to kind of touch on the major theories for the genesis of life on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And that's certainly got to be one of them.
Yeah.
I don't think we have a very good understanding of how life began, or why it should have, you know, how it actually started.
Now, does it constitute, though, something of a challenge for the so-called lay reader, whoever they are, of having a science fiction novel about a planetary confrontation without having life on it? I mean, was that kind of a daring thing to do?
Well, I'm not sure. To me, it made a lot of sense, because it seems to me that what dates all previous Mars books
right.
these kind of funky, bizarre life forms that they postulate that we now know can't live there. And at best, what could live there, knowing what we know now, is a fairly uninteresting, you know, early bacteria or lichen, but probably archaebacteria, the kind of original bacteria that colonized Earth. And so that in itself, as a plot device or as a, you know, we're not going to be talking to these things.
Hmm.
So I thought it was better to go with the probabilities and talk about it as a place where we're going to start a new human world.
Now, is this by way of saying, then, one of the things that you wanted to do in a Mars book or series that maybe had not been adequately expressed before? In other words, as you read the literature that's come before you, I think inevitably any creative person will say, hey, that's great, but...
Right.
There's something here that's not been addressed, and this is my thing, you know? Was that one of your agendas in tackling this?
No, very much so. And I also felt that nobody had until 1976, the most conscientious science fiction writers still couldn't do it right because they didn't have the data from the Viking mission. So we stand on the far side of a giant divide. And on this side of it, we know so much about Mars, about what it looks like and what its chemical constitution is, that we can begin to talk very specifically about what it would take to terraform it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a new idea in history. This is what I find interesting, is that, you know, you read the old philosophers, and they are not talking about terraforming because it's simply outside of their experience. It's not something that they can talk about because they don't know enough about the other planets. But since 1976, scientists can actually sit down at the table and start to crunch numbers on what it would take to turn Mars, the nearest planet, into a living world. And that's just a new idea in history and a completely fascinating thing.
Now, okay, threading throughout the book, though, is this debate, and I guess I'm going to ask you in a moment here if you take a stance yourself,
mm-hmm.
but you've got Sax, and then you've got Anne.
Right.
And there's a critical, there's a critical debate there mm-hmm. where Sax says, we are the consciousness of the universe. We've got to spread it around. It's too dangerous to keep it only on one planet. Changing Mars isn't going to destroy that. He goes on like that. It adds life to the planet, he says. We can transform Mars and build it like you would build a cathedral.
Mm-hmm.
Then Anne says... We are not lords of the universe. We're one small part. We may be its consciousness, but being that does not mean turning it all into a mirror image. She says to him, you've never seen Mars. What a telling sentence that is. Now, first, where are you in this very central argument, it seems to me?
Well, I'm on the seesaw back and forth between the two of them.
Uh-huh.
I think one of the things that has energized me in taking on such a big project as this is that I can see both of their arguments and feel them very strongly depending on what mood I'm in.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a part of me that thinks that this is just a tremendous project, that it ought to be done, and that having been done, it will be magnificent, a sort of a religious act or something like building a great cathedral. And then there's also a part of me that... thinks by analogy that if somebody came in to, say, Death Valley and proposed to irrigate it and put forest in there, I would be deeply offended.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be an insult to the intrinsic value of the place as it is now.
But, you know, I think there's also an analogy here that's very much closer to home for all of us. It's the idea of things like theme parks, where you create a synthetic environment.
Yeah.
You go to Disney, and this is the Japanese pavilion, you know, and it's all...
Right. If you make Mars into a... if you terraform it, you've got a garden that is sort of a Disney Mars, or
mm-hmm.
new thing that is artificial for sure. And you don't have that wilderness. And wilderness is a value that I'm very, very, very much a believer in.
Yeah, or in the construction of our malls and things, that means all around the world you see the same kind of chair, eat the same kind of food. It's all a replica of everything else, and there's nothing individual about one place as opposed to another, one people as opposed to another.
Right.
So what are we getting into here? Are we getting into a kind of an ethnic diversity? And I really don't mean this in any disparaging way, because, you know, we use these terms now kind of as buzzwords, but
mm-hmm.
there is this call for an ethnic diversity here, a respect for that, it seems to me.
You mean in the culture that might grow on Mars?
Right. I mean, one of the arguments is the UN Martian Assembly, you know, going to turn Mars into another Earth with all of the bickering, or are we going to allow it to shape us and let other races propagate, let other races get up there, not turn it into an American-Russian thing.
Right.
Well, I'm not putting this very well.
When I was trying to work it out in my mind and just follow out logically what might happen if we really do go there, it seemed to me that that was going to be one of the main problems, is we'll be dragging along our own cultural baggage, and there are going to be all kinds of squabbles. I think there will be people who go up there and try to reproduce an ideal version of their old national culture. And there are people who are going to be up there who are going to be wanting to make something new and radical.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's going to be another one of the conflicts that will take place there. I think it will be a ground for a whole lot of conflicts at first. But what I've been working on now is the second volume, and so I'm a little bit more aware of, I've been thinking about what it's going to be like for people who are born there. And for me, that second or third generation Martian is going to be much less interested in old Earth culture and is going to be much more absorbed by the new Martian culture, which is going to be some kind of melting pot.
Yeah. And immediately, of course, I'm thinking about Oscar Handlin and all of his theories about first and second and third generation immigrants.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So, and we see that model in Hollywood, where the Jewish moguls, the first, second, and third generations, have radically different ideas about how their own culture will be treated in the movies.
Exactly, yes. I think it'll be even more radical for Mars, where there'll be a completely different world, and where if you've never been to Earth, you're just not going to care about it in the same way.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
I'm hoping that this will... serve as the kind of ground out of which a new utopian culture can be built. And the thrust of my three-volume work is going to be mildly utopian, or at least positive.
Uh-huh. And I'm assuming now that there's going to be the rise of some kind of religious consciousness that we don't know. Obviously, I'm thinking of Hiroko and her... that wonderful scene, one of my favorites, when Michelle...
Yes.
Is sort of embraced into the cult.
Yeah. I'm glad you liked it.
What do you have in mind there? Or, if I may ask, are you kind of feeling your own way along at that point?
Well, I have... Hiroko especially is somewhat of a mystery to me, but mm-hmm. the first chapter of Green Mars is an attempt to tell the story of a childhood of one of her children born in the hidden colony. And so at that point, I've had to think a lot more about what she is about.
Yeah.
And I've been reading about Hildegard of Bingen, who invented the term Veriditas, and various mystics on which I think Hiroko might base her philosophy. And so but I must say that in terms of the novel, I think it's important that Hiroko always remain a kind of a receding figure.
Yeah.
And that she... is a space in which every reader can imagine can sort of cast out in their imagination to find their own religious feeling,
mm-hmm.
so to speak. So I'm going to tread very carefully in that area.
Hmm.
And I think the child's point of view was a good choice in that regard.
And, of course, the direct contrast to her is Nadia.
Yes.
She reminds me of somebody in an Eisenstein movie, you know, the workers' collective, the woman in love with her tractor.
That's right. Well, all those good socialist realist books from, like Concrete. I'm very fond of Nadia, and I think that her practicality is an important component of the whole mix.
Let's talk a little bit now about your decision. Well, no, wait, you know, I'm going to defer that for a minute now, too. You take us on some very extensive tours of the planet.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to imagine what in the world this must have been like for you. Now, are you consulting topographical maps, or are you making up a lot of this?
Oh, no, I've got a book here called the Atlas of Mars, and I've got one of the first commercially available globes of Mars.
Good grief.
Specifically, the Atlas is an amazing piece of work. It was published by NASA as a government document that you can buy for about $10.
Hmm.
And it's got very detailed topographical features, and it's got some of the names that I use.
Now, what about, though, the names that are references to writers? Now, are those your own contributions to the place names? Bradbury Point?
Yes, those are all mine.
Burroughs. Now, what am I missing? Bradbury Point, Burroughs. Let me think here.
Let me think. Oh, yeah, well, you know, the space elevator that comes up from Sheffield and goes to Clark.
Mm-hmm. Clark. Yeah, doesn't Clark write about a space elevator somewhere?
Yes, in the Fountains of Paradise. And in the very same year, there was a book published by Charles Sheffield called The Web Between the Worlds. And it was one of those peculiar coincidences where two science fiction writers came up with the same idea in the same year.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought it would be a nice tribute to use them both when talking about the elevator. And also there's a British town, Sheffield, of course, where there's been a whole lot of industrial work done, including the Sheffield Forge Masters that tried to make that immensely long cannon for Iraq.
Oh, of course. Now, maybe this is just a whimsy, but wouldn't it be lovely if some of these names weren't eventually adopted?
Oh, I would love it.
I don't know how these things happen, but...
Yeah, I mean, names have to be chosen by someone. I mean, most of the names for Martian features were picked out by Schiaparelli with his first map. But it was always a hope of mine that if I created something that was compelling enough that it might have its influences, you know.
Which is to say that in the next generation, somebody tackling this will have a crater or a volcano named Robinson.
No, I would hope so.
I mean, it's only fair play here, right?
That would be great.
But what you've got are all these writers standing on each other's shoulders naming the names.
Yes, well, you know, the Mercury, I don't know if you've ever looked at a map of Mercury, but there's similar topographic maps for Mercury, and the International Association of Astronomers decided to name all of the craters and major features on Mercury after great artists, painters, and musicians.
Mm-hmm.
So that you've got...
that's a lovely idea.
Van Gogh crater, and inside Van Gogh crater, there might be a little one called Rimsky-Korsakov. It's a very bizarre, beautiful map.
Now, as we are going on these tours with Nadia and Anne,
mm-hmm.
Now, ordinarily, frankly, I would have been bored to death, ordinarily, because this, at times, was a little bit like Jules Verne's 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, where we have endless... passages of exploration, but even though that's my own Achilles heel on this stuff, I still was fascinated because I kept thinking, how are you doing this? When you are going on these tours with them, as it were,
mm-hmm.
what are you having to dig for the most? In other words, what are your weak points? Are they ecological ones? You even talk with Michelle, you're talking about psychological typing.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about the mining. The teleo operations. I mean, where in all of this do you come up short? I mean, where are you flawed like the rest of us?
Well,
the range of knowledge is amazing.
I think it's all equal in the sense that I am just one step ahead of the game, and when I see what the book needs, then I go out and I read extensively and with a certain skill that I've built up in strip mining resource materials for what I need
mm-hmm.
for my own purposes.
And how to get a ship through thin atmosphere, how to get radiation protection when they're on the Ares early on.
Right, but all that is research done specifically because I needed it for that chapter.
So you kind of set up your own obstacles.
Yes, and I sit in a knee-deep pile of resource material.
Mm-hmm.
I buy it at used bookstores or Xerox out of university libraries or whatever.
Gosh, I'm wondering if we're defining what a science fiction writer does, is setting up obstacles and then worrying about overcoming them.
Yeah, well, I think that should be the way the game is played. And I also have been I've been reading a pamphlet called Science News, a periodical that comes out weekly. I've been reading that now for about 15 years straight, week in and week out.
Mm.
And that's like a newspaper of all the sciences that tells you what happened that week at the cutting edge.
But, you know, you're making this very tough on other writers because you're setting a kind of standard or precedent here that's pretty overwhelming.
Well,
well, this isn't fair. Most
let
of us
suffer.
Yeah, you know, most of us are doing well if we can master one of these scientific endeavors that they go through here.
Well, a general scientific education is really, I think, part of the job, and reading something like Science News for 10 years can do it, you know, for you, or any other way that you can get it.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, for me, this is what I find entertaining when I read myself. And it always seemed to me that there has been a little bit of shying away in science fiction from really getting into it and talking about things in more depth than the usual novel does.
Mm-hmm.
And I always thought that Isaac Asimov was very instructive in that sense, in that Asimov does not fear to just go ahead and dive off the edge and talk about something for 50 pages at a stretch,
mm-hmm.
where he's just basically talking science.
Well, in a way, Melville does the same thing in Moby Dick.
Yes, exactly. In fact, the 19th century novel has always been an encouragement to me, and when I see people like Asimov or, say, Umberto Eco with his books about the Middle Ages becoming a bestseller, it just seemed to me that readers were interested in this stuff and that you didn't have to be scared of actual content in the novel,
mm-hmm.
that the novel is a very capacious form. And that it could handle a more information density than people had been giving it credit for.
Mm-hmm.
And so certainly Melville and Balzac and Dickens are all completely filled with tons of real-world information.
Mm-hmm. Tell me now a little bit about, take me to the writer's workshop here, your decisions to split the narrative off into different voices.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we start off with, who is it, I guess Maya, is telling a lot of it early on.
Right.
How did you choose which ones? Because, you know, we never see it through Arcady's eyes, if I recall.
Right, that's true.
Tell me about the decision on choosing which ones to, you know, to slip into their consciousness.
Well, at each point I wanted to make it, once I knew what the general history of the planet was, I wanted to choose the point of view character for whom the story would be the most interesting for the reader. And that was a kind of a subjective thing, and I don't know if I can be too much more specific than that,
mm-hmm.
but it doesn't always mean the person that is at the center of the action. For instance, choosing Michelle, I mean, in a way, he is absolutely not at the center of the action and learns about things by surprise. And as you say, I never chose to use Arcady as a point of view character, except very briefly in a little section of italics.
Oh, yes, excuse me. That is there, right.
But that doesn't really count. What that does, I think, is tantalize the reader with a whole world of rebel activity that's going on that you suddenly realize that you don't know about.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually think that there's kind of a vacuum effect where if you crave knowledge when you're reading a novel, that this is a sign that the novel is working on.
Yeah, you must have had somebody like Bakunin in mind when you thought of Arcady,
mm-hmm.
strikes me.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that whole anarchist,
mm-hmm.
Everyone from Fidel to Bakunin and also Bogdanov, the Bolshevik who wrote Red Star, was an amazingly charismatic figure.
Really? I see.
Yeah.
Now, are we going to be seeing any artists, musicians, painters, writers springing up in this culture?
Well, yes, I would hope so, but I always figured that would be a somewhat later development, except for kind of performing arts.
I mean, it intrigues me, for somebody growing up a first or second generation Martian, what would they write about and call it science fiction?
Right, right.
This, I'll leave that one to you.
That's a daunting thought.
They would write about Earth, I guess.
Imagine what their realist literature might be like.
Right.
My gosh.
Let's see. Where else do I want to go with this? Yeah, now this is what a bleak. It really is a bleak view of humanity, isn't it, when you see what's happening to Mars there near the end. My goodness.
Well, I would hope that isn't the total picture, you know. I mean, in the sense that the second and the third volume will get beyond that. But it certainly was a bleak couple of chapters. And but I only can say that when you face history and you're trying to write a realistic book rather than just, you know, a completely utopian one, mm-hmm. that you've got to include that element.
Yeah.
And also, I mean, right when I was working on this book, we got into the war with Iraq, and the world is just in such a flashpoint. You know, wars are still all too possible, and a lot of times I think they happen for irrational reasons, and that they get out of control of anybody, including the leadership.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I had done a lot of research on the start of World War I. And it made me realize that it would be completely justifiable to have a crazy war happen.
Yeah. Also, you have a habit of referring to things that only much later, at least, you know, unless I miss something, only much later do you really fully understand what it is you referred to 100 pages ago.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like reading something by McLuhan, you know. The continuity gets continually dislocated. Which, in a sense, is very realistic.
Yeah, I feel that this is the way we are in real life, that we only begin to understand our own past in bits and pieces.
Right.
And continue to go on.
And it's also a nice strategy, is it not, to keep us reading?
Yes.
Because we're intrigued, or we're downright irritated. Well, what the hell is that? You know, and so you keep plowing on, hoping to find the answer to that. It kind of makes explorers out of us.
Yes, and also detectives. And I'm a big fan of the detective motif in literature, and I feel that if you've got a mystery that you're going to read on to solve the mystery. And in fact, I was having big trouble with John Boone's gigantic chapter in the middle of the book until I comprehended that it ought to be organized as a detective story.
Well, you know, it's a real shock when we hear later on, I think it's after Boone's narrative, that this guy was maybe a little bit of a rat at times with all the kinds of women, or were these just rumors? In other words, he remains very mysterious to us. He's not just the untarnished shining knight, is he? Or what's going on there? Do you recall what I mean?
Oh, definitely. But that all comes in a sort of a mythologizing.
Yeah.
I mean, it comes in that section immediately after his chapter when people are telling tales about him that includes stuff that you've never heard about before.
Exactly.
Which definitely wanted to be in there as kind of a shocker. But also, I mean, think about what we've learned about John F. Kennedy since, and think about what we thought we knew about him in 1963.
Yeah, very interesting.
I mean, those are radically different figures.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of myth-making and stuff, oh, what a nice ring it has, the first 100.
Mm.
You know, I think of, like, first fandom, for example.
Mm-hmm.
That's a nice, I mean, is that going to continue to be with us, references back to the first 100, you know?
Certainly. I mean, especially, they're very much like the equivalent of the Founding Fathers, but there's only just 100 of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sticking with them because of this longevity treatment.
I'm
going to be using some of them as point of view characters right through to the end of the novel. I mean, to the end of the trilogy. And it's important to me, I think, for that the readers have that kind of continuity. So we'll be hearing a lot more about them.
And I may be way off here, but it seems to me in one of the Burroughs novels, Burroughs somehow treats the idea of an immortality drug of some sort. I may be way off on that one. I'll have to double-check all that.
Well, I confess I'm not up on the Burroughs novels, although I've read the first couple Mars books. Several of the Tarzan books.
The Gods has always been my favorite, because there he's dealing with religious cults, too.
Is that The Gods of Mars?
Yeah.
Let me see if that's one I've got.
That's are you able to hear me if I keep talking?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the one where when John Carter returns, he ends up finding his son.
Oh, well, I'll have to look that one up. No, I only have...
Oh, I shouldn't have told you that. That's one of the great revelations in that book.
That's all right. I'll forget it.
I'm sorry.
I'm good at forgetting these things.
Oh, it's Barnum.
The first one and the fifth one, the Chessmen of Mars.
Yeah.
How many others?
I think it's far and away the best in the series because of the religious cult thing that he runs into when he comes back.
Ah, well.
But I'll leave that one to you.
Okay, I'll look for it.
Tell me now a little bit about what has happened. This came out in 93, but it spanned how much time in its gestation here?
Well, I started doing the reading for it in the early 80s. And in fact, I wrote a short story that laid claim to the title Green Mars.
Yeah.
In the early 80s, and then I started writing the novel that you read in 1989. And finished it at the end of 91, and then it got published in England in the fall of 92, and then just got published here in February.
Now, what was the severest criticism, if any, that came your way from any of the editors that you may have worked with?
The editors were basically ready to publish it as I sent it to them.
Wow. So you did not have to argue, defend, or eventually relinquish anything?
I defended a couple of passages that one of the editors wanted to cut out, and I basically was given carte blanche to publish whatever I chose to publish.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm glad that I did, because this included things like, you know, Michel's, his psychological theory, for instance.
Yeah.
And I felt that these were really important. And the editor, I think, was a little afraid that it was just not normal practice to have such, you know, gigantic expository passages,
right.
Whatever what you want to call it.
Uh-huh.
But I prevailed, and I think people like that part of it, so I'm encouraged to go on.
Mm-hmm. And then since its publication, where on whatever side of the ocean it came, what's been coming your way in the way of awards, recognitions? Have you been hearing from some of the writers that you've already mentioned as being, you know, people you've emulated or enjoyed? Or?
Well, it's been getting a wonderful response. It's been very encouraging since I'm still working on, you know, I feel like I'm still working on the book. I think of it as just one book that is three volumes long, like a Victorian three-decker.
Right.
So when I get when people have liked this first volume, then it really encourages me to go ahead and throw caution to the winds and put a full effort into making the second and third one as good as the first one.
Well, has somebody like Bradbury, for example, been in touch?
No, Bradbury did not read it. It was sent to him by Bantam because that's his publisher as well as mine, but he said he just doesn't have time to read anything these days.
Mm-hmm.
Arthur C. Clarke read it, and you probably saw the
right
comment that he gave for the book.
Yeah.
It's been getting good reviews and comments from my generation of science fiction writers, and I've heard from some of them that they've kind of recast their notion of what they ought to do with their own works after reading it.
Well, that's another thing. You know, does the face of planetary adventures, specifically the Martian sagas, will it be changed inevitably as a result of this book? I don't expect you to answer that, I guess, but...
I would hope that it would make a mark on what people could do in as far as Mars novels afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that successful novels, especially in science fiction, you know, after Le Guin's Left Hand of Darkness, there have not been very many attempts at a Winter World, for instance.
Yeah.
And after Dune, there haven't been too many attempts at this kind of desert world.
Although Dune's concerned with ecology and things.
Yeah, that's right. And in fact, Dune is very much of a Martian novel in itself, I think.
Yeah, that's true.
But you know, I think that successful big novels do make a mark. They create a kind of a rain shadow that in there, for a while afterwards, people will have to deal with them one way or another. And you know, I would hope to create that kind of effect.
Well, now, aside from the fact that this would take somebody, it would take probably a $300 million budget and a director who's a cross between Eric Rohmer, Jim Cameron, and Joan Micklin Silver to pull this off. Do you think this could ever be a film?
Well, someone wrote a review in which they said it's a cross between 2001 Lawrence of Arabia and My Dinner with Andre.
Exactly.
So I have no idea. I feel like someone could go out there into Death Valley, and given what computers can do these days, that in fact it wouldn't be grotesquely expensive or no worse than any other big budget film.
Well, you know, if you have a chance, you might go take a look at this new Disney film called A Far Off Place, the desert locations, the Kalahari Desert and some other locations in Africa. All the time I'm watching this, I'm thinking, my God, what a great location this would make for your book.
Oh, okay. Okay, I'll look for that.
It's really quite startling.
Yeah, well, I tell you, there are places on Earth that are unbelievably Martian. And
yeah.
One of them is quite close to Hollywood. It's out there in Death Valley. And so, you know, I try to think about the movies as just a lottery ticket that I have bought.
Mm-hmm.
And if I happen to win the lottery, it will be a similar kind of miracle. But in my daily life, I don't worry about it very much.
Now, does it go without saying that if you had a chance to hop a rocket right now and be among the first humans to set foot on the surface, you'd do it?
Oh, yeah. Although I'd have to work out the old family situation.
Or if you have incipient claustrophobia, I don't know if that would be too good either.
I'm ready to. I would love to do it. I mean, I've spent so many years looking at these maps from above and trying to imagine what it would look like on the ground, what with the tight horizons because of its smallness and all this kind of thing, that I'm very curious at this point to see what it would really look like, because some of these features are simply astonishing when you look at the numbers. I mean,
well, in effect, have you established in your mind then a separate consciousness that says Mars? I mean, everything you see is filtered through it and ends up somehow coming out here, as the song says, you know?
Yeah, it's certainly true that almost anything I do in my life these days, and for the last 3 or 4 years, that everything seems relevant because it's about the making of an entire society that, you know, I'll think about economics, or when I'm out in the mountains and I'm looking at mountains, alpine flowers, or it's just amazing how much seems to actually be relevant to the subject, and I'll try to, you know, remember the details so that when I write it, it has some kind of physicality to it.
Now, certainly, you're one of the most respected figures in the field, and it's going to take me quite a while to catch up with your other works, but have you been able to give up the day job yet?
Oh, yeah, I have been writing full-time since 85.
Wow, amazing.
And this is partly because, you know, my wife is an environmental chemist and has a full-time job.
Hmm.
But I've been, you know, making my share of the family income.
Mm-hmm.
Five. But that's because I've been publishing about a novel a year.
And is it, on the whole, a heck of a way to have to make a living, or?
Oh, it's wonderful. Mostly I've been working under a kind of a head of steam that I think would have existed whether or not there was any kind of economic necessity.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, I want to write stories as fast as I can get them down, and so the fact that I'm getting paid for it is just a great luxury. And also, I've been able to move where my wife's job takes us and still do my work, and I've also been able to do the primary child care for my 4-year-old boy.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, I was only working half-time for his first 2 years of life because I was taking care of him full-time while my wife worked.
Amazing. Okay.
Yeah, so I was writing during his naps and in the evenings. And that was what I was doing for most of the first part of Red Mars.
Now, will you be able to be coming cross-country into the Midwest anytime soon, or?
Well,
I mean, do you go to conventions and things?
I go to conventions. Rarely travel very far for them.
My father tells me that we may have met. Were you at the, was it the Science Fiction or World Fantasy Convention in, it was near Chicago. It was a suburb. Had a peculiar name. And I remember I interviewed a bunch of people there because I was working on a 50th anniversary piece on Bradbury. Julie Schwartz was there and a bunch of other folks. And it was in some gigantic hotel area outside Chicago.
Was it a Worldcon?
Yeah, and it was about 2 years ago, I think.
Yeah, no, I missed that Worldcon.
Yeah.
I wasn't there. There's a Case for Mars conference, which is a bunch of scientists who are getting together to do workshops about going to Mars.
Well, this is interesting.
Habitats there. And in fact, their conference proceedings has been a gold mine for me.
Now, this has already convened somewhere?
It's a yearly thing in Boulder, Colorado.
Now, say the name of it again.
The Case for Mars.
Wow.
And its proceedings are these gigantic, thick books that are published by the American Astronomical Society, and anybody can buy them, and there they sit.
Who do you find at these gatherings?
Oh, it's mostly people from NASA and also from the aerospace industry who are attempting to make the shift over into, you know, non-defense projects.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a planetary scientist for whom this is a passion like it is for me, except that they, like, there will be a guy who will come in and his entire workshop proposal will be for a glove, the proper Martian glove.
I see.
And then his paper, when published in the proceedings, will be about the proper Martian glove. So when you've got a book like that, a chapter like Chapter 3 of Red Mars is just deeply indebted to the work of scores of scientists who have tried to work out the details of what it would really be like.
Now, I had one last question.